Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
At six locations where the Indians attacked last night, unprovoked, the blatant aggression that they did, Pakistan has lost 26 civilians and 46 are injured.
Dozens of people have been killed in the worst fighting between India and Pakistan in more than two decades. Tensions between the nuclear-armed states soared after a deadly attack on Indian tourists in Kashmir last month. Now India has retaliated in both Kashmir and in Pakistan proper in the worst attack on Pakistan in half a century. Then in a historic settlement, Columbia University and New York Presbyterian Hospital have agreed to pay $750 million to hundreds of women who were sexually abused by the former Columbia OBGYN, Dr. Robert Haddon. We'll speak with two of the survivors.
News of the settlement, $750 million, is monumental. It's a huge win for all survivors, Haddon survivors. It was a long, hard battle that we fought.
Then the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights has found the U.S. border agents who fatally beat a Mexican father in 2010 responsible for torture. One of the agents accused of covering up the death of Anastasio Hernandez Rojas has now been nominated by President Trump to head the Customs and Border Protection. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. India and Pakistan are exchanging heavy artillery fire across the line of control that divides Kashmir into Indian and Pakistan-administered areas. The cross-border fighting began after India launched a major military operation with a series of airstrikes on nine sites, including targets inside Pakistan. A Pakistani military spokesperson said the strikes killed at least 26 people and wounded dozens, including civilians. Among sites hit was a mosque in Pakistan's Punjab province. This is an eyewitness.
They hit the mosque directly, destroyed its courtyard, the minister's office in front of the mosque, and the roof. Everything was crushed. There was one person sitting on the roof on duty. He was martyred.
Meanwhile, Indian officials say at least 10 people have been killed and several wounded by Pakistani attacks on Indian-administered Kashmir. India's foreign minister called India's attacks a measured response to the massacre last month of 26 people in the Kashmiri resort town of Pahalgam, an attack India blamed on militants backed by Pakistan's government.
India exercised its right to respond and preempt, as well as deter more such cross-border attacks. These actions were measured, non-escalatory, proportionate, and responsible.
Pakistani Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif called the Indian attacks an act of war. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has canceled an upcoming trip to Europe and is holding high-level cabinet meetings. Both India and Pakistan are armed with thermonuclear weapons. In a statement, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons warned, quote, a nuclear exchange between India and Pakistan would cause millions of immediate deaths in the region and have global consequences, unquote. We'll have more on this story after headlines. Israeli attacks on Gaza have killed another 31 people, including 13 Palestinians who died when Israel bombed a school again east of Gaza City. A separate attack on a tent encampment for displaced Palestinians in Deir al-Balah killed three people, including a child. Amidst the unrelenting attacks, Hamas said it would no longer engage in ceasefire talks due to the catastrophic famine set off by Israel's total siege of Gaza, now in its ninth week. A spokesperson for the United Nations Aid Coordination Office said Israel's unlawfully weaponized food, water, fuel, and medicine.
Aid should be provided based on humanitarian need to whomever needs it, targeting those who need it most first, and not be used as in any way as a tactic to move people to any particular place or to convince people to do this, that, or the other. It is to cover their basic life-saving needs. Punto.
Israel's military bombed the main airport in Yemen's capital Sana'a on Tuesday, an attack that set passenger jets on fire and disabled the airfield. Yemen's Houthi movement says the bombing left three people dead. Elsewhere, witnesses reported at least four other Israeli strikes across the capital region. The Israeli attacks came as President Trump said the U.S. would no longer launch attacks on Yemen, after the Houthis reportedly reached out and expressed that they, quote, don't want to fight anymore, unquote. A top Houthi negotiator later said the U.S. ceasefire did not apply to Houthi operations against Israel. In Ukraine, a Russian missile attack on the city of Sumy on Tuesday killed three people, including a child. At least 10 others were wounded in the attack, most of them children. The strike came as Ukraine launched a third consecutive night of drone attacks on Moscow, a barrage that came as foreign leaders, including China's Xi Jinping, are heading to Moscow for a Victory Day parade commemorating the Soviet Union's defeat of Nazi Germany. In related news, the Washington Post reports the Trump administration's urged the Ukrainian government to accept an unspecified number of U.S. deportees who are citizens of other countries. Even though Ukraine lacks functioning airports to receive deportation flights due to constant Russian attacks, this follows reports the Trump administration is offering cash payments or political concessions to several African nations to accept deportees from the United States. The U.S. Senate's confirmed Frank Bisignano as Social Security Commissioner, an appointment labor leaders warn could lead to the destruction of Social Security. He's a banking executive with a net worth estimated at nearly $1 billion. In March, he declared, "I am fundamentally a Doge person," referring to Elon Musk's efforts to gut federal agencies. He was confirmed Tuesday on a party-line vote, 53-47. Among those voting no is Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren.
Frank Bisignano will rubber stamp Trump and Musk's attack on Social Security. He'll let them keep slashing services. He'll let them keep threatening benefits. And that's going to hurt people everywhere, from seniors who count on their monthly checks right now, to the parents of kids with a disability supported by Social Security, to every American who is paying into the program now for results later on down the line.
The U.S. Supreme Court on Tuesday temporarily allowed the Trump administration's ban on transgender military members to take effect. The measure will be enforced while legal challenges are resolved. In response to a slew of anti-trans executive orders signed by Trump, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth in February ordered an immediate ban on transgender military recruits and halted all gender-affirming medical procedures for active duty military. Hegseth also issued a policy giving the military 30 days to identify trans service members and remove them from their positions. In response to the Supreme Court's decision, Hegseth said on social media, quote, "No more trans at DOD, no more dudes dressed in dresses. We're done with that." He used the S word, which rhymes with hit, Hegseth said, using the expletive. In immigration news, a federal appeals court in Boston has rejected the Trump administration's attempt to revoke temporary deportation relief for an estimated 400,000 immigrants from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela living in the U.S. under a two-year parole protection granted to them by President Biden. In related news, two federal judges Tuesday blocked the Trump administration from using the Alien Enemies Act to expel Venezuelan immigrants without due process. U.S. District Court Judge Alvin Hellerstein's ruling halts the removal of immigrants under his court's jurisdiction in New York, while a preliminary injunction issued by U.S. District Judge Charlotte Sweeney bars Trump officials from removing Venezuelans detained in Colorado. These are the latest legal defeats against Trump's mass deportation plans, coming after a Trump-appointed judge in Texas issued a permanent ruling against Trump's use of the 1798 wartime law, rejecting Trump's claim of an invasion by the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua to justify the expulsions. Meanwhile, a newly declassified memo shows U.S. intelligence agencies privately rejected Trump's claim that the Venezuelan government directs Tren de Aragua, a claim that was key to Trump's invocation of the Alien Enemies Act. This all comes as more details have emerged in the case of another Venezuelan man who was illegally sent to El Salvador's maximum security mega prison in March. Trump officials removed 20-year-old Daniel Lozano Camargo from the U.S. in violation of a 2024 legal settlement that prohibited immigration authorities from deporting him while his asylum application is pending. Lozano Camargo came to the U.S. from Venezuela as an unaccompanied child last month. A federal judge in Maryland ordered his return. In El Salvador, the government of President Nayib Bukele is reportedly preparing to issue arrest warrants for several journalists working at the acclaimed Central American independent outlet El Faro. In its announcement, El Faro said a reliable source with close government knowledge contacted the outlet staff, issuing the warning, which came after El Faro published an interview with two former gang leaders who revealed new details on a power-sharing agreement with Bukele and his years-long complicity with gangs. In a statement Monday, El Faro said, quote, if carried out, the warrants are the first time in decades that prosecutors seek to press charges against individual journalists for their journalistic labors, unquote. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney met with President Trump at the Oval Office Tuesday, where he rejected Trump's call to annex Canada as the 51st state.
Having met with the owners of Canada over the course of the campaign last several months, it's not for sale, won't be for sale ever.
In response to Carney's remarks, Trump said, quote, never say never, while Prime Minister Carney mouthed the words never, never, never. Trump also said during Tuesday's Oval Office meeting that nothing Carney could say would persuade him to lift U.S. tariffs on Canada. In Florida, the family of 23-year-old Roger Fortson, an Air Force member killed by a sheriff's deputy inside his own home last year, have filed a federal civil rights lawsuit. The suit alleges Deputy Eddie Duran used excessive and unconstitutional deadly force when he shot Fortson just seconds after he answered the door of his own apartment. Fortson's family said police arrived at the wrong home and that Fortson grabbed his legal firearm as a precaution. Police body cam footage showed Fortson answering the door with his gun at his side, not posing an imminent threat to the officer, who immediately shot Fortson six times. Fortson's family is being represented by the civil rights attorney, Ben Crump. And in Tennessee, jurors on Tuesday began deliberating in the trial of three former Memphis police officers charged with murdering Tyree Nichols, a 29-year-old black father who died after the officers brutally beat him during a traffic stop in January of 2023. Tadarius Bean, Demetrius Haley, and Justin Smith were convicted on federal charges last year. State prosecutor Tanisha Johnson was the last attorney to speak to the jury on Tuesday before deliberations.
If you follow the facts in the law, your mind can rest easy that there sits three men who are criminally responsible for the murder, the aggravated kidnapping, and the aggravated assault of Tyree Nichols, as well as official misconduct and official oppression. Find them all guilty as charged of every charge.
Two other former Memphis police officers involved, Desmond Mills Jr. and Emmett Martin, have pleaded guilty to state charges and are not standing trial. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Dozens of people have been killed in the worst fighting between India and Pakistan in more than two decades, following a deadly attack last month on Indian tourists in Indian-administered Kashmir. Early today, India attacked nine locations in Pakistan and Pakistan-administered Kashmir, killing at least 26 people, including a child. Dozens were wounded. Pakistan called the attacks an act of war and responded by shelling areas of Kashmir under Indian control. India says the Pakistani shelling has killed at least 15 people. Pakistan claims to have shot down at least two Indian fighter jets. Tensions have been soaring between the two nuclear-armed nations since April 22nd, when gunmen massacred 26 tourists in Indian-administered Kashmir in a rampage that India blamed on Pakistan. For now, we go to London, where we're joined by Mirza Wahid, award-winning Kashmiri journalist and novelist. His books include The Collaborator, The Book of Gold Leaves, and most recently, Tell Her Everything. His recent Guardian piece is headlined, A Massacre Has Reignited the Forever War Between India and Pakistan. Once more, Kashmiri voices are missing. Well, they're not missing here, Mirza Wahid. So if you can start off by talking about what's at stake right now and give us the progression of what took place. First, the attack on Indian tourists in Indian-administered Pakistan and Indian-administered Kashmir and what that means.
Thank you for having me. Those killings were reprehensible, and it was a massacre of Indian tourists in a pristine, really idyllic meadow in Pahalgam, where I lived as a child. And it's a very gorgeous and beautiful place. And those killings were shocking, obviously, and condemnable, reprehensible. And that is the main trigger for this, you know, recent escalation now. Because soon after the killings, there was obviously outrage in India, in the public, in the media, across the society and the political classes. And we very soon we heard big clamors for war, especially in the media. So a lot of pressure to strike on targets in Pakistan, and it was kind of, we knew it was happening. Obviously, one hoped it shouldn't happen, it wouldn't happen, but that's what's happened now. And in many ways, I mean, this is an old war. This is a very, very old war, and not as old as the American president believes it to be, not centuries old, but about 75 years old. My grandfather saw the first India-Pakistan war in 1948. My father saw the wars in 1965 and 1971. And then in 1999, a limited war over Kargil. And I have seen 1999 and now this recent, the latest escalation. This is a dangerous escalation. It's a dangerous intensification because as your preview said, people have been killed on both sides of the border, almost all of them civilians. That has to be emphasized and noted, that people who've been killed in the shelling are all civilians. And as we speak, in the borderlands between Indian and Pakistani administered Kashmir, people are hiding in makeshift bunkers, in underground shelters. Some of them are kind of contemplating leaving. The main airport in Kashmir is sealed off, as are other airports in some parts of northern India. There's a huge amount of fear in the public. And this is that old thing, isn't it? When elephants fight, it's the grass that gets trampled upon. So Kashmiris have been kind of in the middle for a long, long time now. And it fills me with despair as a Kashmiri person, as a writer, as someone who's kind of thought about it and written about it. It fills me with a lot of despair. And I'm upset about the killings in Pahalgam, about the subsequent clampdown in Kashmir, where thousands of people were arrested, houses of families who are linked to Kashmiri militants demolished, and now these strikes and the counter-offensive from Pakistan. So I'm really, really upset, and I didn't sleep last night because you were worried. We didn't know what we were going to see in the morning.
And Mr. Waheed, you mentioned that this has a long history, that there have been numerous conflicts in past decades. But at the heart of it, why has it been so difficult to resolve, and why have the Kashmiris fallen under both a Pakistan-administered territory and India-administered territory?
I'm going to try and give a basic sort of primer on history. See, we go back to the partition. India and Pakistan become modern nation states. Kashmir is left unresolved. Soon they begin their first war over Kashmir in 1948, which is then brought to an end through UN mediation. There's a ceasefire. In fact, it's an interesting thing I must note. The line of control that divides two parts of Kashmir right now was actually called a ceasefire line, a CFL, which came into existence soon after the first war I mentioned in 1948. And then it was formalized and renamed as line of control in 1972 after India-Pakistan fought another war, which resulted in the creation of Bangladesh. So they have fought these wars. And it's very clear. I mean, they have fought over Kashmir historically, all my life and my father's life. And there's three generations of Kashmiris and Indians and Pakistanis who have kind of, you know, grown old or with under this threat of war. It kind of there's relative periods of peace between the two countries, and then something will bring about a fresh escalation, right? As the attacks in Pahalgam have done. They haven't been able to solve Kashmir. India kind of has in recent years claimed that it's kind of brought Kashmir to normalcy, but this doesn't look like normalcy to me. There's the fighter planes. Pakistan claims it's kind of brought down fighter planes. India has hit. This is also unprecedented because India has hit targets inside Pakistan. In previous escalations, previous conflicts, they would hit targets inside Indian Pakistan and also Kashmir, all of Kashmir, you know, being a disputed territory. But this time they have gone into targets inside Punjab, inside interior Pakistan, which is what I cited as a very, very dangerous intensification.
And how has the leadership of Prime Minister Narendra Modi affected relations between Pakistan and India, his increasingly nationalist stand in India?
Yes, it is a different regime than previous regimes. They are more open to armed response, which we have seen. And they believe, and they say they had a presser where they said that they have responded in retaliation to the attack in Pahalgam, as they did in 2019 when there was an attack on an Indian paramilitary convoy in Kashmir, in South Kashmir, in which about more than 40 Indian paramilitary troopers were killed, and then there was a strike in Balakot, which is in Pakistan, opposite Kashmir. But this time they have kind of gone inside Pakistan. The Indian government claims that they have resolved Kashmir, by which I mean they, in 2019, they revoked Kashmir's limited autonomy under the law, you know, under Indian dominion. And said now tourists are coming, it's returned to normalcy, the economy is looking up, and Kashmir is normal. But it is not normal, because what happens is, you see, you can't impose solutions. You can impose order. You can impose law and order. You can't impose peace. And it's clear that this is imposed peace, and it's now blown wide apart. And I really, really worry. And until they solve Kashmir, my worry is that it's going to come back to haunt the two countries again and again. And nobody wants that. Nobody wants that. Least of all, the Kashmiri people. They're tired. They are tired of the enormous, enormous suffering they have seen over the last 30, 40 years. Thousands and thousands of Kashmiris have been killed. And people in India and Pakistan, they have been killed. And it's in nobody's, interest for this conflict to continue to claim lives like this. And You know, I was thinking earlier that I really miss the old days when, you know, when people used to be opposed to war and warmongering. But now I also want to kind of point out that we're now at a point in history where, you see, back in the day, we used to look up to the United States and Britain and Europe, and because phone calls would be expected to be made to the leadership in India and Pakistan, urging restraint, urging people, calmer minds to prevail, and so on and so forth. But now that order is collapsed, post Gaza, it is collapsed. I don't think the Americans and the Brits have the same legitimacy. I mean, not that they had much back in the day, but, you know, there was at least the semblance of this expectation that, you know, phone calls would be made from London and Washington to urge restraint. But I don't think they have the same legitimacy and same influence, Mirza, as they have.
We just have 30 seconds. These are two nuclear armed nations. The final comment on the significance of this.
Solve Kashmir. The two countries have to solve Kashmir. Otherwise, they'll keep kind of, they'll stay engaged in this forever war.
Mirza Wahid, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Journalist and award-winning Kashmiri novelist. We'll link to your recent piece, A Massacre Has Reignited the Forever War Between India and Pakistan. Once more, Kashmiri voices are missing. When we come back, a historic settlement. Columbia University and New York Presbyterian Hospital have agreed to pay $750 million to hundreds of women who are sexually abused by the former Columbia OBGYN Robert Haddon, while Columbia ignored his patients who spoke out, undermined prosecutors, and shielded the sexual predator. We'll speak to two survivors and the lawyer who accomplished this settlement. Back in 30 seconds.
Said you're gonna shoot me down, put my body in the river. Shoot me down, put my body in the river. And the whole world sings. Sing it like a song. The whole world sings like there's nothing going wrong. He shot her down, he put her body in the river. He covered her up, but I went to get her and I said, my girl, what happened to you now? I said, my girl, we gotta stop it somehow.
The Body Electric by Alinda Segata of Hooray for the Riffraff in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez here in New York. An historic settlement is being hailed as a landmark victory for hundreds of women who survived abuse by the former Columbia University gynecologist Dr. Robert Haddon for over 20 years. While Columbia ignored his patients who spoke out, undermined prosecutors, shielded the sexual predator. On Monday, a Manhattan judge approved the settlement in which Columbia University and New York Presbyterian agreed to pay $750 million after the former doctor abused the women under the guise of medical examinations, legal payouts, and now top more than $1 billion following earlier settlements. Altogether, it's the largest in U.S. history with a medical institution. Dr. Haddon was sentenced to 20 years in prison in 2023 for molesting his patients. Columbia University said in a statement to the Associated Press Tuesday, the settlement was, quote, another step forward in our ongoing work and commitment to repair harm and support survivors, and said it's, quote, implementing a multi-pronged plan, including an external investigation, a survivor settlement fund, and a series of new and updated patient safety policies and programs to address the abuses of Robert Haddon. For more, we're joined by two women who sued after surviving Haddon's abuse. Lori Maldonado was a gynec. Lori Maldonado is with us. She was an OBGYN patient of Haddon's between 2003 and 2012. Eva Santos Velos was just 18 years old when Haddon was assisting in an emergency delivery, and she says sexually abused her. We're also joined by their attorney, Anthony DiPietro, who's representing hundreds of sexual abuse claims by former patients of Robert Haddon. We welcome you all to Democracy Now. Lori, let's begin with you. It has been years now, but this is an enormous accomplishment, not just the money settlement, but the laws you all have gotten passed, for example, in New York State alone, to allow people who've been abused decades ago to be able to come forward and sue Dr. Haddon, who's in prison, but also take on a medical institution. If you could quickly, and if you feel comfortable, saying what happened to you, and Eva, I want to ask you the same, and then what it took, even if it took years because of whatever your reasons for coming forward. And your response to the settlement.
Yeah, thank you so much, Amy. I know Democracy Now! Has covered our story numerous times. I think we've been on here 4 times, so thank you. It means so much. The settlement is huge. It was just a huge win for all of survivors, including Haddon survivors, but all of survivors. And I also have to say that it took a really long road to get there. Anthony DiPietro has been at that fight for more than 10 years. A lot of us have just joined or have been in it for years, but there's been so much coming forward. And it really has been on the voice of survivors and the bravery of survivors sharing their stories, their vulnerabilities. And it's been survivors who've notified other survivors to come forward. You know, Haddon is the biggest sexual predator in the history of the United States. Eva and I are a few of thousands of women that he sexually abused. I was sexually assaulted 2 days before the birth of my son. But there are so many women that were...
you went to him because you were about to give birth.
Yes.
And you thought, he said to come to his office rather than the hospital for a checkup.
Yeah. 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 So, and the pain that he caused, the physical pain, it was just egregious.
How long did it take you, and when did you realize that this was, you were not alone?
Oh, gosh. I first found out when a woman came forward, Lori Kanya came forward, called 911. There was in the newspaper on the subway. It was like, gyno is a sicko. So that was my first.
So you're looking across the subway at the guy across from you, and they have a newspaper and a picture of your doctor, gyno is a sicko, and you go, that's Dr. Haddon.
That's my doctor. And that's my doctor of, you know, almost 10 years. Like, that's my doctor of, you know, that I, my first OBGYN. And so so it was women kind of notifying other women. Other people have been notified by Instagram, on subway ads. And, you know, I first was following it, and I first, of course, came forward to, I was moved to another doctor and just asked, was this, you know, was this a medical procedure? No. And you know, at that point, Columbia, you know, they kind of do their best to sort of silence you. So it took me a while. I think it took me a while to overcome the shame and the fear. And then once I did, and I came forward to Anthony and was a part of this legal lawsuit, I really found my voice. And I noticed that the more that I spoke, the more women came forward. So that happened again after, you know, and we're really... It's women's work. It's survivors' work. But there's legal's work. We've had investigative journalists. There's so many things that have happened.
And Laurie, when you mentioned that Colombia did what they could to silence you, could you talk about that, the fact that the university for so long had to be aware of what was going on, but did nothing about it?
Juan just asked you, Laurie, you said Colombia silenced you, but did nothing about it. Explain what took place. I remember seeing you when Manoush Shafiq, the former president of Colombia, was being inaugurated, and the survivors were there, all these medical doctors at Columbia, residents, students in their white coats protesting, demanding that Columbia alert all of the patients of Haddon about what, you know, what he's being charged with if they wanted to come forward.
Oh, my goodness. There were Columbia University, they never notified patients up until a few days before survivors had a chance to take legal action. So there was more than 6,000 patients. And yeah, they finally notified after protest. And that was really important.
I'd like to ask Eva Santos if you could talk about your situation. Specifically, you were undocumented at the time you first dealt with Dr. Haddon or were a patient of his, and how that affected your ability to speak out?
Sure. So, I mean, being undocumented back then in 2008 was the main reason why I couldn't speak up. I felt afraid of being a Latina woman in a country that already doesn't stand up for us. And I just felt really afraid and ashamed if they were going to believe me. So I didn't say anything. I bottled it up for years until I was finally able to see powerful women like Laurie, like Marixa come forward, that gave me the courage to know that I was going to be protected. Also, Anthony Di Prieto gave me the power and courage to finally know that what I went through was real and it wasn't something that was just being silent and hidden by Colombia.
You were giving birth to your first son at the age of 18, and you were in an emergency delivery, and this guy walks in?
Yes.
2008.
Yeah, I was 18 years old. This was my first birth. During my labor, he sexually assaulted me multiple times, not just once. I was there for many hours, and he used his power in order to make me feel like what he was doing was right.
You were undocumented, afraid to come forward for years?
Correct. Yeah, I was really afraid to come forward, but I'm no longer afraid. They will not silence me. It's something that Colombia has the power of doing, believe that they have the power of doing, but they don't. And I will continue to use my bullies to hold them accountable, regardless of my status.
I wanted to ask Anthony Di Pietro to talk about the evolution of this case, how you got involved, and the numbers of people that have come forward.
Again, Anthony cannot hear Juan, but Juan asked how many people were involved, how many women survivors, how'd you get involved in this case?
Yeah. So to date, our firm has represented 808 women who have come forward to report on being sexually exploited and abused by Robert Haddon at Columbia University. The really tragic part of this is that the university knew all the way back into the 90s about what he was doing and how he was mistreating patients, but did nothing but lie, covered up, and expose more unsuspecting patients to a known serial predator.
But explain, I mean, actually, you have achieved altogether with your settlements over $1 billion. Columbia University, and you can explain the different medical institutions where he worked, Columbia Presbyterian, representing people like Evelyn Yang, who is the wife of the presidential candidate, everyone learning from everyone else, women who came forward. Explain how that were over $1 billion Columbia is paying out. What did they not do? When did they know that he was a predator?
Yeah, so Columbia knew all the way back into 1995 when a patient wrote a letter to their chairman. And who wrote back? He acknowledged receipt of the letter. She wrote to the chairman, risk management, and the hospital itself. And they did nothing except cover this up. And the reason why these cases are so important is if you look at what happened at Columbia with Haddon, at Weill Cornell with Darius Padauk, at Michigan with Larry Nassar, USC with George Tyndall, UCLA with James Heaps. The one thing these institutions have in common is that the one thing these cases have in common is that the institutions always know the abuse is happening. So it's important that we make them, we hold them accountable. We hit them where it hurts, because the only thing they really care about, and they've shown this again and again, is their money and their reputation. And so it's really important that they understand that we're here, we're watching them, and we're going to hold them accountable if they don't take proper action.
Can you explain something? This is not only about Columbia, it's also about the Manhattan DA, who is Cyrus Vance at the time. It is astounding the deal they made with him, and explain that.
It's outrageous. So in 2016, over 20 women had come forward to report the abuse to the district attorney's office in New York City. That included a fellow employee of Robert Haddon's, an employee of Columbia University. They indicted him for 6 women. The district attorney's office then allowed Haddon to pick any 2 of the 6 women that he wanted, plead guilty to them. One of them he made oral contact with. Another one of them he forcibly assaulted. And they gave him what more closely resembles an early paid retirement instead of a sentence for a sexual felon. No jail, no fine, no community service. They didn't even take his license. They allowed him to surrender his medical license.
And no jail at that time.
Nothing.
What caused him to go to jail?
Not a thing. I'm convinced it is the collective voices of all these women who have come forward, who would continue to talk about this. This case started back before, you know, the term Me Too was in the public consciousness, before anyone heard of Nassar, unless they were a patient of his being abused by him. And the dialogue kept going and growing, and the movement kept gaining power. Ultimately, it was the letter that was found in Utah from Columbia's chairman, who apologized to the patient in 1995 for being assaulted, and he told her he was going to take care of this when he got back from vacation, and never did a thing except cover it up and expose more people. And ultimately, when those reports started gaining traction, that seems to be when the federal prosecutor stepped in, indicted him again, and now he's in prison for what hopefully will be the rest of his life.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask Eva, and maybe Anthony DiPietro could also talk about this. What kind of long-term changes has Columbia agreed to that you think are most important?
I think they haven't agreed to anything other than the settlement. They haven't done anything other than cover up this abuse for many, many years. Maybe they have offered a patient safety clinic, something like that, but nothing has really happened. We are in conversations with the Attorney General's office to see how we are going to have institutional accountability, because, again, this cannot just stay on a settlement offer payment, because they have all the money to continue to pay abuse as much as they many more years. What is going to happen in each clinic and each hospital to make sure that this doesn't happen again? They have yet to say that, and we are waiting for them to come forward and say how that's going to look like.
Many people are getting Robert Haddon's name off your child's birth certificate.
Yes.
That's part of the deal.
Yes.
And for Eva, you now have 3 kids. You're DACA. You talked with me earlier about how your mother was your support, but also feels guilty about not speaking out earlier. What message you have to young, vulnerable people who are terrified to come forward, yet know, and you knew from that moment in your greatest pain around delivery, that there was something really bad happening here?
I'll say more than anything to trust yourself. Trust yourself. Once you have that feeling that something is wrong, something is definitely wrong. I knew it since the first moment that he did it, and I've been holding it ever since. And it's just a matter of trusting yourself and using the people around you and your community to be supported and come forward and know that you have the protection, you have the resources, you have great lawyers like Anthony De Prieto that will support you along the way, and great collective sisters that, like I found, that has made this journey easier, or else we would have been, I would have been really alone throughout this time.
These are the largest settlements in U.S. history, well over $1 billion, vying with USC, right? University of Southern California, Anthony.
Yes, that's correct.
Women, the average that they'll be getting is?
Just over $1.3 million on a per case average, which
and
is the highest amount.
Number of women who are involved at this point?
576 in this current round.
Can other women come forward now that we'll hear this?
Yeah, so each case is going to have to be evaluated on an individual basis. You know, the work that everyone has done so far in passing a law called the Adult Survivors Act, passing a law called the New York Gender Motivated Violence Act, those statutes provided a temporary time frame for people to come forward, file a case, even those beyond the statute of limitations. Those have now ended, but there still could be opportunities for people to come forward on an individual basis.
And finally, Lori, your final comment as this chapter comes to an end. Robert Haddon in jail, Columbia and the Met and the hospital being held accountable. Your son is 17 years old. You were assaulted a few days before he was born.
Yeah, I think this, again, this is like a big win for us, just like Haddon being convicted. But when we were in court with Haddon, you know, he was put in handcuffs and taken to jail, and we were assured that he would, you know, never harm anybody again. That was the end of that. But there was nobody in the courtroom representing Columbia, and still to this day, they haven't done much, you know, in terms of hearing our voices, in terms of making internal changes, in terms of external investigation, and that's what we're trying to put forth. And so, you know, my hope is holding Columbia accountable to that same level. And that is really a lot of, I feel like survivors are a force to be reckoned with. We are a strong group. We do a lot of incredible things. And one of the things that Eva was really highlighting was, you know, our work with the Attorney General's office. Like, if, you know, we know if we want Columbia to change, that it's survivors that need to hold them to accountable. So we're really, you know, so this is huge. And at the same time, we have lots of work to do to make sure that this never happens at this scale again.
Lori Maldonado, Eva Santos Velos, and their attorney, Anthony T. DiPietro, representing hundreds of women who were sexually abused by Dr. Robert Haddon, now in jail for decades. When we come back, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights finds U.S. border agents responsible for torture in the beating death of a Mexican father in 2010. Stay with us.
Pasando el trapo sobre la mesa y está cuidando que todo brille como una perla. Cuando llegue la patrona, que no se vuelva a quejar, no sea cosa que la acuse de ilegal. Se atiende los jardines, parecen de Disneyland. Maneja una troca vieja sin la licencia. No importa si fue taxista allá en su tierra natal. Eso no importa para el tío Sam. Hielo anda suelto por esas calles. Nunca nunca se sabe cuándo nos va a tocar.
El Hielo, or Ice, by La Santa Cecilia, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights has found Customs and Border Protection agents who fatally beat Mexican father Anastasio Hernandez Rojas are responsible for acts of torture. It's the first time the independent commission, which investigates extrajudicial killings and human rights violations, has issued such findings against a U.S. law enforcement agency. In 2010, Rojas was crossing the southern border in an attempt to return to San Diego, where he'd lived for 25 years to reunite with his wife and five children after being deported. He was stopped by border agents who brutally beat and tasered him while he was handcuffed until Rojas died from heart failure. His death was later ruled a homicide. In 2012, Democracy Now! Spoke to an eyewitness who recorded footage of the fatal beating. This is Umberto Navarrete.
Anastasio, face down in handcuffs, and two officers on uniform. And there were five officers in the near area right there when I started recording. Two uniform officers, one of them had one of his knees on Anastasio's neck. The other officer had the other knee on Anastasio's lower back. I started noticing all these details, and the most important thing was that Anastasio was not resisting, and that's when I decided to pull out my cell phone and start recording what you can see on the first videos, and that's when I started recording.
The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights findings on the killing of Anastasio Hernandez Rojas comes nearly a decade after his family filed a complaint in 2016. And this comes as President Trump's nominee to head Customs and Border Protection, Rodney Scott, faces questions about whether he obstructed the criminal probe into Rojas's killing in an attempt to cover up the border agent's actions. Democratic Senator Ron Wyden raised concerns during Scott's confirmation hearing before the Senate Finance Committee last month.
In 2010, he led the U.S. Border Patrol in San Diego. While in that position, a migrant who crossed the border was detained by CBP officers and severely beaten while in their custody. The man we've mentioned, Mr. Rojas, died of those injuries, leaving behind his wife and five children. Rather than following the agency's own policy and immediately referring the incident to outside investigators, the San Diego CBP office began its own inquiry. In the course of that investigation, the CBP officers taped over the only video copy of Mr. Rojas' death and tampered with physical evidence, according to court documents. In an action that the former head of CBP Internal Affairs called illegal and possibly obstruction of justice, Mr. Scott signed a subpoena to obtain Mr. Rojas's medical records, which Customs and Border Patrol then refused to release to the San Diego Police Department.
Rodney Scott has yet to be approved by the Senate to head Customs and Border Protection. For more, we're joined by Andrea Guerrero. She is executive director of the San Diego Alliance. Welcome back to Democracy Now! If you can start off by talking about the significance of the findings.
Well, good morning, Amy. The decision from the Inter-American Commission is a catalyst in the fight for dignity in the United States. It exposes the unchecked powers of policing in the United States and holds the United States accountable for what is one of the worst violations in human rights, which is the taking of a life, and points to the U.S. policies as deficient and deadly. And that is a really significant finding for us in the fight for justice, in the fight for reform. This applies to all law enforcement, local police, federal agents, who are now being called to change their ways, and policymakers are being called to change their policies to avoid repetition so that no one has to suffer what the family of Anastasio Hernandez Rojas had to suffer.
And Andrea, is there any direct or legal impact of the commission's findings on the U.S., on the U.S. government?
The way the Inter-American Commission works is it issues recommendations, and until and unless the United States complies with those recommendations, it will remain in a monitoring status. It will be monitored by the commission for the duration of its reforms. And so the equivalent to this in the United States would be a consent decree. When a court takes a police department under its jurisdiction in a consent decree to monitor it for reforms, to make sure that it institutes the reforms to avoid repetition of the harms it has caused in the past. And so what we're looking forward to is the United States complying with the recommendations of the commission, which are threefold. One, to reopen the investigation of the agents involved in both the abuse, torture, killing of Anastasio and the cover-up, to repair the damage to his reputation and apologize to the family, and three, to reform its laws and policies, namely its use of force laws and policies to align with the international human rights standards, which limit the use of force to that which is necessary and proportional. In the United States, we have a unique standard, unique in the world, which allows officers to use force if it is objectively reasonable. That standard is far from the international standard of necessary and proportionate, and it must change.
And the issue of the President Trump's pending nominee to Customs and Border Patrol, Rodney Scott, being part of that original cover-up, can you talk about the implications of that?
Yeah, unfortunately, the CBP commissioner nominee, Rodney Scott, is implicated in the decision from the Inter-American Commission. Rodney Scott was in charge of the San Diego sector of Border Patrol when Anastasio was killed, and he directly participated in the cover-up, principally by overseeing the cover-up teams called critical incident teams that were later disbanded because they never had any congressional authority to operate and because of the obstruction of justice that they were engaged in. In the case of Anastasio, Rodney Scott oversaw these teams and their destruction of evidence, and he also personally authorized an administrative subpoena that was used to acquire Anastasio's medical records from the hospital. And the reason why this is important is because he knew that he was using an immigration subpoena for a criminal homicide matter that he had no authority to be involved in. It was an investigation of his own agents, and he used this administrative subpoena to acquire evidence or information about Anastasio's medical and records in order to mitigate the liability of his agents. Now, everyone should know that administrative subpoenas, administrative warrants, are not self-executing. They are not judicial warrants that can compel the evidence or a witness or a person in a search or a seizure. And so this is a violation of the Fourth Amendment. It's a violation of federal laws that limit administrative subpoenas to administrative matters. And that's not what Rodney Scott did. And I think what was most damning in the Senate hearing last month was that Mr. Scott said not only that he had authorized an administrative subpoena in the course of a criminal homicide investigation that he had no business being a part of, but that this was common practice and is common practice. So, you know, the way we see it is a person who cannot recognize abuse of power or participated in abuse of power is not a person who should hold power.
And we will see what happens. Again, the confirmation hearing has been held, but Rodney Scott has not yet been confirmed by the full Senate to be head of Border and Customs Patrol. That does it for our show. Andrea Guerrera, we thank you so much for being with us, Executive Director of the San Diego Alliance. You can visit democracynow.org to see all the coverage we've done on the death of Anastasio Hernandez Rojas. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Stay tuned for the One World Community Radio program on 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, 88.7 FM WRHU, Hempstead Radio, Hofstra University, 88.1 FM WCWP, Brookville, LIU Post, 88.3 FM WRCT, Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University, 88.3 FM WVCR, Loudonville, Siena College, 98.1 and 105.9 FM WKZE Salisbury Red Hook, and around the world at WRHU.org. This is One World Community Radio, coming up next on your favorite community radio station.
Radio program, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio, Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. Broadcasting from the Bush Radio Salt River Studios in Cape Town is host me, Lydia Mahwanana. Broadcasting from WRHU Studios in Hempstead, New York, are your hosts, Cody Millar and Andy Gladding. We welcome you to join us for the next hour as we celebrate the power of community radio, music, language, and culture. The world is a big place, but using the power of radio, we're bringing it right to your door. Now, Bush Radio and WRHU welcome you to the one world of community radio.
FM WRHU Hempstead, Radio Hofstra University, 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, the mother of community radio, and 88.3 WRCT Radio Carnegie Tech in Pittsburgh. I'm Ricky Hubert, and you're listening to the One World Radio Show. We also have the fabulous Lydia Mahwanana joining us in Cape Town, South Africa. Lydia, how are you?
I'm doing fantastic, thank you. How are you, Ricky?
I'm all right. We were talking before we got on that we both have papers due because it's that time of year. That time of year, I have something due as we're taping this due tomorrow, and you have something due later today. But the beautiful thing is, Lydia, by the time this airs, we'll be done with it and it'll be out of our hands.
Definitely. Like, I can't wait until the submission time and I am done.
I think we all can relate to that. I think all the students finish strong because we're getting closer to the end. So you guys, you're going into winter now, right?
We are getting into winter, so it's the last lost legs of autumn on our side. So, yeah, getting ready for winter, my favorite season.
I like winter. I like winter too. I'm a winter person. Maybe we'll find out. Maybe we'll find out what our guest's favorite season is when we get to talking to him. So our guest today, because not just Lydia and I talking, it's we have a wonderful guest today, Dr. Chedrai Kumanyika. And Chedrai, thanks so much for coming on our show.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Thank you. So for those who aren't familiar with your work, tell everybody a little bit about what you do.
Well, I'm an assistant professor in New York University's Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute. I teach a variety of things to do with journalism and media, but I also make podcasts and the documentary kind of storytelling kind of podcasts. And so I recently released a podcast called Empire City.
So you're a professor of journalism. You work in podcasting. I think there's a point in everyone's career, kind of, if they're passionate about something, which I assume you are based on the work that you've done. When did you first get the bug for journalism and storytelling?
I spent a lot of time, particularly, I would say, between 2005 and 2013, listening to public radio. I mean, I listened to public radio before that. I grew up, but I really started honing in and really becoming a real fan during those years. I think it was during those years where, you know, you're driving around. I was driving around, living in different places, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, and just listening to the radio, I was like, wow, you know, this is like incredible storytelling, listening to like This American Life and some of those shows, but also listening to interviews and shows. Like, there was a show called The Combat Jack Show that was a podcast. And so I think that was when I really got the bug, because I realized there are incredible stories. I'm learning a lot. And then because it's radio, it's reaching all these people in ways that, you know, typically like scholarly work doesn't.
So you really listened to it from 2005 to 2013. You had mentioned that the reach of radio. What was it about kind of the storytelling? Because audio journalism, I feel like, isn't something that's as prominent as visual journalism. Like, we were having someone discuss the other day. They were doing something about food, and they said that's visual journalism because it's good for the ear. No, good for the eye, rather. My apologies. Visual journalism, good for the eye. But you're talking about stories for the ear. So why do you think that's so powerful? What got you kind of hooked into that? And how did you use that public radio sphere to get into your own work and what you were doing?
Well, I think there was two things about radio that really caught me. One is, you know, I mean, you know, we have a saying in radio that, you know, radio has the best pictures. And I think when people say that, what they mean is that because you're listening, you have to kind of create the pictures and images in your own mind. And in that way, it requires like a different kind of mind, like your brain switches to a kind of different mode. You know what I mean? And at the same time, you know, that idea of someone's voice telling you a story in your ear, that's probably like one of the oldest, you know, human forms of sharing information, sharing ideas. And even as an individual, like, we know the voices of our parents and our family probably before we're even born, right? Because you can hear them in the womb. So I think that there's like something very intimate about that. And also, one other thing I'll say is that at a time in the world where a lot of people have made up their minds what they think about different issues, I found that, you know, radio that tells a good story is a good way to surprise people. I found myself surprised, right? You follow the story because you don't know where it's going. You don't know where it's going to land. And in that way, you're maybe more open to have your mind changed in ways that fairly rare, I think, in today's times.
So what got you invested? Because you said you had listened to radio all your life, right? You listened to public radio. So when did you first discover that you wanted to go into journalism? Was it at a younger age? Was it through that time listening? And kind of tap into that a little bit.
I mean, I did my first formal radio sort of like podcasting workshop in 2013. It was the Transom Workshop, and it was led by Rob Rosenthal and Jay Allison and David Weinberg and others. But I guess I should rewind a little bit to say that, you know, one of the big things that influenced my career was that I was in a hip hop group for a long time, starting in basically in 1995. And I've been a hip hop artist for like a huge chunk of my life, going all the way back to probably like fifth grade. So that was where I first got used to kind of like hearing my voice, experimenting with my voice, really listening closely to other media. And, you know, because hip hop is also a place where great stories are told. I think that that influenced me. And I also, you know, I learned how to use Pro Tools.